Good evening, everyone. It's nice to see you all. Thursday night, our usual rendezvous. Especially in these uncertain times that we live, it's nice to have some things that we can feel like we count on, that we will be here on Thursdays. Although my own internet is a little dodgy these days, so it may just cut off at some time point, but I will come back immediately if that happens. I read an interview today in the New York Times with a woman who was the former CEO of the company Patagonia. I don't know if you're aware of this company. They make things like this, outdoor gear, this is their logo, and they make, jackets and outdoor gear. And they are famous for being radically environmentally conscious and socially conscious, and that fleece, for example, is made out of recycled plastic. It's not like this one, which is probably not very good for the environment and is made in Bangladesh by children or something. They're very socially conscious. And anyway, this woman who was the CEO stepped down in the summertime. And this was an interview with her about what she does and what she's doing now and why she left and everything. She didn't really say why she left, apart from the fact that she is a practicing Buddhist, and that she was citing Buddhist teachings in which at some point the student has to leave the teacher. And she was saying that the founder of this company, Patagonia, I think he's French or Swiss, Yvon Chouard or something like that, Chouard or something, anyway. She felt like he was her teacher in a sense, although she had, she's an experienced businesswoman and had worked with other companies before. She had been a financial advisor, advising people how to make money basically, and went to Patagonia because she wanted to learn from him. And she didn't go into much detail, but she said it was time to move on. So, the interviewer asked about how her Buddhist practice affected her business life, her professional life. And one of the things she said was that she said in the Eightfold Path, one of the 8 points is right livelihood. So that means, earning your life, making a living in a right way, right? And she said the way that she applied that was, we're not here to chase material wealth. We're here to learn how to develop a compassionate heart and become better people. And that in turn makes the world better. And the interviewer said, well, now you're in, she left to join the board of directors of a company that is developing electric cars and another company that is developing food alternatives to meat. So, you could say it's false meat, but it's not meat, Okay, it's alternative foods that would replace meat. And he said, so you're still in business. And he said, you know, how even, you know, you're in the auto industry now. So how can you really apply this, your principles? And she said, yeah, you know, whenever you're in business, and this applies to all of us in our lives, there is some harm that will be done. That's the nature of the activity, business, as a general term. But the key is to recognize that and act then from that recognition. So act accordingly, to limit the damage that's done. Try to do things that are less harmful and become better people, more compassionate, and then making the world a better place. And when I heard this, I thought, you know, this applies to all of us, not even if we're not in the business world. Just by living, we know that there will be harm. We know this when we study the precepts, that by living, we have to kill. In order to live, we have to kill. Whether it's the cells in our body, whether it's the plants that we eat, or meat that we eat, it's a constant, we're constantly doing wrong, let's say, doing harm. And so what we say in our Buddhist practice, in our Zen practice, is that we, like she said, exactly, the key is becoming aware of that and then limiting it and choosing to cultivate not doing harm rather than not paying attention to it and amassing material wealth or not of doing things that are only good for me but not good for others, not seeing the oneness of life. The pandemic had, she, you know, in kind of a very passing way, said, yeah, it's funny how the pandemic has showed us all how connected we really are. I don't think the journalists picked up on this as being a Buddhist notion, but it doesn't matter. It's a really good point, and I think everyone in the world to some extent has realized that through this pandemic, of how connected we are. We don't always see the depths of it, and we don't act from that realization. You know, the debates about locking down or wearing masks or opening shops or not, or restaurants, all of this is different approaches to how to address the fact that we're all connected and that all of us are affected by the same thing in a multitude of ways. So the virus makes us sick, some people sicker than others. Some people don't have any symptoms, some people die. And then, as we've said numerous times in the past year, the consequences of that are just unfathomable. We can't even begin to see all the consequences from it. Whether economical, social, educational, health, environmental, the consequences are just unlimited. Like with our vows, right? We have our vows that are all about this being, you know, sentient beings are numberless. It's just too vast to even conceive of. We can't even count them all. delusions are inexhaustible. They're never end, unending. They just go on and on. Reality is boundless. It has no limits, reality. And the Buddha way is unsurpassable, we say. And these all sound like these impossible, incomprehensible vows. Because we say, well, then we vow to save all these people, all these beings, even though we can't count them. We vow to put an end to these delusions that don't end. We vow to see this reality that's boundless. Well, how can we possibly see it if it doesn't, if we can't contain it, you know? And the Buddha way is unsurpassable, but we vow to embody it. We vow to be it. How can we be something that is like so far up beyond everything else? And we always chant the vows in that order. However, I was once at the Shambhala Center, Tibetan Center, in the center of France. And on the wall in the temple that we were using, there were these beautiful Japanese calligraphies. And four of them, these long banners. And so I asked someone what they were. And he said, oh, the translations are on pieces of paper over there on the wall. And so I went and looked at them. And they were kind of weird translations, but it was the four vows, translated in a kind of different way. And he told me that they had been made by this Japanese Zen master who had come to the United States, to San Francisco, in the 1960s with Suzuki Roshi. And his name was Koben Chino Roshi, and he had become a friend of Trungpa, who is Trungpa Rinpoche, who was the head of Shambhala. And he made these calligraphies for him and gave them to Trungpa. And so now they were hanging here in this temple. And so I said to the guy, so do these papers correspond to these things? And he said, yeah, that's the order. This is number one. This is number two. This is three. And this is four. And I said, well, you know, they're not in the order that they're supposed to be. I know these four vows, and that's not the order that we recite them in. And the guy said, oh no, that's that he wrote these papers and he put those numbers on them and that's how they're supposed to be hanging. So I thought, okay, you know, why not? And that really kind of opened my mind to the fact that we don't have to chant those vows in that order. We do. And every Zen community I've ever been in has always chanted them in that order. But why not? Why not change the order? I'm not going to do it, but at least now. But the point of the vows is not necessarily that order. Probably there is some, you know, cascade effect that is sought. And, you know, Joa could maybe tell us in his research if there's some thing about these vows that have to be in that order. I don't know. But experientially, if I look at those vows, I don't need them to be in that order. It's almost as if they're all the same vow. And sentient beings, that's everybody and everything, right? Which is also reality. We could say it's a little different interpretation of reality and sentient beings because things that aren't sentient beings are included in reality. But the fact that reality and sentient beings are numberless and boundless, we can't find the end, we can't find the beginning, we can't find a separation, because that's also what that means. sentient beings are numberless. They're all one, actually, is what is being said. Delusions are inexhaustible. So delusion, this is an interesting one because it used to be translated as desires when I first started this practice, and maybe Joa too, I don't know. If you remember, it was desires. And at some point we changed it. I don't know, Roshi changed it or somebody changed it. And it became delusions. Some centers still in our lineage still chant desires, however. I think that's the traditional version. Well, and if you look at the word desire, I think it's probably the same in Portuguese, the same root from the Latin, comes from Latin. Now, what's the word in Portuguese for desire?
Desejo.
Right, so it's probably the same root, I think. It comes from the Latin word, which I don't really know how to pronounce Latin, but it's desiderare, which is to wish for something, to long for, to wait or expect something. But it's actually awaiting for what the stars will bring. It's from sider, is from the stars. That part, sider. And that, I think in Portuguese, is probably the same thing. It's from the Latin for stars. And so it's like longing for something that is far away, for something that's not here. The stars are like out there. We can never reach them, actually. In fact, we're looking at them, some of them are already dead. We know that they've already burned out and we're still looking at them. We are seeing them, but they're not there anymore. So desires are a really beautiful thing. It's this fabulous longing for the stars, you know, longing for, it's like inspirational. It projects us. That's what motivates us to do things often, is desires. The problem in the Buddhist context, we say, is that we become attached to it, to the desire. And then there's all kinds of problems because we become attached to what we don't have. We live our lives, you know, longing to grasp that star that in fact is already dead, instead of seeing the stars that are right here. So when we look at it in that context, I personally understand the relationship to delusions then. Because delusions are also, a delusion is believing in something that isn't there. That it's having an idea about something, but that's not really what it is. And an illusion, I think in French we say illusion, don't we? No. Do we say illusion in French? Yeah. In English, it's different, illusion and delusion. Illusion is temporary. It's kind of like this. This is an illusion. It's illusory, but I will eventually see what it is. And the illusion, you know, it's like when you're driving in the highway on a hot day and you see that looks like there's water on the road, but when you get there, you see it's not. So that there was this illusion of water, but actually there's not. Whereas a delusion is something fixed and embedded. And we live our life according to that delusion, believing we're someone who we're not. For example, that's the big one. And in that sense, it relates to desires, because desires in this context are wanting longing for something that's not there. And delusion is believing in something that's not there, that isn't what it is, believing it's what it is not. You know, we could take a really concrete example of people who are deluded into believing that Donald Trump won the election in the United States. But every vote was counted and Biden had more votes. It's a delusion to believe that Trump won the election. That's just a really concrete one. But I, like I said, our basic delusion is this belief we have about ourselves, of being this particular identity that we're stuck with and having all these beliefs about it, and then have all these positions that are born of that fixed position and acting according to that and not seeing the oneness, this delusion that we're separate from one another, like that. So when we say, you know, delusions or desires are inexhaustible, it's true in the sense that every moment we need to be present to what is and not be fixed on what we think is there or how we want it to be, or not be focusing on the stars. We need to be here with what is here and now, every moment. And so at every moment, there is potentially a delusion. And this notion of my attachment to self, we have to renew that, letting go moment to moment. And so when we say I vow to put an end to them, it doesn't mean that at some definitive point there will be no more delusions. It means that my vow is to every moment be attentive to that and aware of that, and to live from that knowledge. Like, you know, the businesswoman who acknowledges the harm she does, and then moment to moment trying to live from a way that limits harm or eliminates harm or promotes wholeness, promotes goodness, promotes compassion. And in the same way, reality is boundless. So what is reality? I know I was with Corinne Sensei's Sangha in Hamburg this weekend. Well, I was in Paris, they were in Hamburg. I was leading a writing workshop for them. And the four vows came up, and they don't chant reality is boundless, they chant the Dharma gates are boundless, which I guess Corinne has gone back to a more traditional, I'm sure she dug around somewhere and found some more traditional version of it and wanted to use it. So I thought about that too. And I thought, well, why not? You know, reality, that's the Dharma gate. That's the Dharma is everything, you know, so, everything is an opening. Everything is a gate. Maybe reality is a little less specific or something. Speaks to me more than Dharma gates, but for me it seems more concrete than Dharma gates, but why not? You know, the notion is that they're boundless, whatever it is. If you want to call it reality or you want to call it Dharma gates, it's endless, it's boundless. There's no, where can we say this is a Dharma gate and that's not a Dharma gate? What is reality and what's not reality? So, and then we get the Buddha way. You say it's unsurpassable. Well, it doesn't mean that it's unsurpassable in the sense of it's impossible. It's above everything. It means that it includes everything. It means that it is everything. So there's nothing that is not it. And when we say, I vow to embody it, that's a vow to realize that you are it, that you are the Buddha way, that you are reality, that you are delusions, that you are all sentient beings. You know, you could almost say these vows in the opposite. Start with the Buddha way is unsurpassable, and then your reality is boundless. And if we truly see this, but I saw somewhere recently that Thich Nhat Hanh said, in Zen, true love is true love is eliminating the division between myself and others, or something like that. And that's true. When we see that we are not separate, that's love. When we see the oneness, that's love. When we see that we are the Buddha way, that changes everything. And all of the things that we hear, you know, all of the all of our koans and all of our things we chant, they're all talking about this. About this, you are it. My teacher gave me that Dharma name because that's, in my experience, there's nothing else, you know, that's the ultimate teaching. That's the basic teaching and the ultimate teaching. So I guess she realized that that's what my teaching would be and gave me that name. And if we truly see that, then we will choose to not harm. You know, we have this koan that is famous outside of the Zen world. What is the sound of one hand? Sometimes it's, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And it's often cited as this really enigmatic thing, and people make jokes about it, and then it's, you know, made out to be this thing that some Zen master with a shaved head sitting on the top of a mountain is the only one who can answer it, or something. But the truth is that you all can answer it. Everyone I have worked with on that koan has answered it. So I have no doubt that you all can answer it. The question is, well, what does that mean to answer it? And what does it mean, one hand? What does it mean, the sound? So that brings us to look into, you know, well, what is sound? What is one hand? What is one? What is a hand? And means really looking into it, though. It means really digging in and questioning, inquiring into it. It's no different from anything else I've been saying, you know. It's a true reflection of Zen, of Zen practice. Zen relates to everything with wisdom and compassion. I suppose we could even say, you know, the Mahayana school of Buddhism relates to everything with wisdom and compassion, but because we have specific Zen practice, I would say that that's... wisdom is seeing the oneness, and compassion is then acting from that. It's having the compassionate heart that this CEO of Patagonia talked about. And the sound of one hand is about that as well. You know, we even have the statue of one of the Buddha's statues. I forget what it's called. Maybe it's called the teaching statue or something. I don't know. But it's one of the postures where he's sitting there and he has one hand in his lap and the other hand is touching the, it's pointing to the ground or touching the earth. And that touching the earth is indicating that right here, right now, is the Buddha way. Right here, right now, is the throne of awakening. Right here, and that's a deeply wise and compassionate act to point to the ground and indicate that this is it. If we really saw that, if we really understood that our body is the body of the earth and our body is the body of the others, we would treat the earth differently and we would treat others differently. If the world passed this koan, wow, it would be a different place, you know? That's our world. And so how do we respond to this world that we live in that isn't filled with people acting with wisdom and compassion? And even ourselves, we don't always act with wisdom and compassion. So what do we do? How do we respond? You know, can we have the humility to, like this woman who is the CEO of Patagonia, to say, yes, I acknowledge that I will do harm. Can we have that humility to say, yes, I sometimes am harmful, I harm myself and I harm others sometimes. And then what do I do then? That's the key. So that's a lot of blah, blah, blah. If you would like to ask a question or say something. I'm sure everyone would like to hear it, including me. Joel?
Yeah. Yeah, about the order, it's rather striking how the vows actually mirrors the order of the framework of the Four Noble Truths, in fact, and the tasks that are that the corresponding tasks also that are implied in the Noble Truth. But it's true that, and at the same time, it's true that when we practice one of these tasks, we actually do them all, or we can't do one without the other. We cannot just practice the Eightfold Path without doing the first task, which is to really embracing life, comprehend the suffering. But also what I would like to add is what I find very striking in the vows. I find kind of another element, another flavor that is put into it is, so we have this first noble truth about the suffering and about, our existential condition. And so what is requested, what is suggested, what is implied is the task of embracing our existence, our condition, our who we are. But here with the vow, it introduces the other, the relational aspect. And I find that very inspiring. And I wonder even how we can pull that string and say that we really embrace life when we really embrace the other. When we really are engaged, not just in the world with me and the world in general, but the world ultimately is our people, are made of people, not just mountains and rivers, but people. And so I'm very inspired by that very kind of relational aspect. And of course, and that's the trademark of also, of, as you mentioned, of Mahayana Buddhism and the vow of the Bodhisattva is really to be engaged with others. And that I feel that's something maybe that is added to that first task of embracing life that mirrors the first noble truth, that relational aspect, deeply, deeply rooted in our practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Debbie?
I'm studying the Course of Miracles with some people on Wednesday nights. I don't know if you know this thing. It's a very long, kind of heavy, Christian-oriented. It's Jesus and the Holy Spirit and God. Discussion of, I'm not sure what, miracles. How to heal oneself and others. I've already confessed to everybody that I don't always follow what we're doing. And then at the same time, there are moments when it's very Zen, and I know what we're talking about. But I tried to do it on my own, and I couldn't do it. So I'm sticking with this for the moment, even though a lot of it goes by me. But also, the it's very God, he, and the Holy Spirit, he, and I can get bogged down in the vocabulary, although people are working at not making it too masculine. But one of the things that is very, crosses over what you all were just saying, is that the insistence over and over again that the miracle and the Holy Spirit and the fact of living in God's kingdom in this world or whatever, the language kind of goes beyond me, but you know what I mean. It can only happen with the others. This can't be one of these, I love mankind. It's with other real living human beings, tolerating them, finding places where we can communicate, it comes up again and again, the notion that the, if you're doing this on your own, you're not, you're cheating, but we haven't, you haven't understood it yet. It has to be with other people. And it's, I become more and more aware of that too, because I have a tendency, I can be a very good Buddhist if nobody's in the house. As long as nobody challenges me, I'm great. The minute there, the cat shows up, the minute another living being annoys me, it's a whole different story. But it's remarkable to me that in this Course of Miracles, it's restated over and over again. It has to be done with the brother sisterhood, or it doesn't have any, or it's not real, I guess, is the point that they're making all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know the details of the Course in Miracles, but it's a very famous thing. I've heard a lot about it. And yeah, I mean, it is. It's a, that's why we say, you know, you can't, we have, you know, I have a statue back there, but that's not what the practice is about. You know, Genpo Roshi used to say, yeah, if you want to have your teacher be your statue, well, then you'll become a piece of wood. You know, it's like, it's about interacting with living beings, like you say. Yeah.
I can totally sympathize with what Debbie said. And I find, like, with this particular time that we have with confinements and seeing less and less people, I do find that is very challenging, because I was talking about that today actually with someone, because I mean, I think a lot of us, our social life is very much about Zoom, very much about Zoom meetings, and it's very easy to switch off, and after that they're gone. But I've just spent a week with my friends and with real people for a week, 24 hours a day. And it's not easy. I have to admit, it's really not easy. I think I need to pay attention to the fact that with all these series of confinements and less social interactions, we may become more... I may become more fixed or more rigid, and it's difficult. I find it's a challenge.
We all become a bit weird.
Joanna?
So, hello. When I was hearing you speaking about compassion, I realized that for me, like, kind of translates into cooperation, but I don't think that's it. I think that's not what you're meaning, although you're not, you know, offering a solution. What does compassion mean? Because it depends on the situation, of course. But I don't know, in my head, it always means cooperation, and sometimes cooperation is not what's needed, right? Sometimes we need challenge, and sometimes we need other things. And I was just, you know, can you just talk a bit more, like, what could compassion be? I don't know, it's just that.
I don't think I would use the word cooperation interchangeably with it, but I like the version of Thich Nhat Hanh of true love is when the division between self and other disappears. And compassion is that what naturally arises from that view of that experience of oneness. It's sometimes we say it's the functioning. So we function, we act from this place of oneness, meaning we do no harm because it's me. You know, we wouldn't want to hurt ourselves. Do you have your hand up, Thelma? Yes?
Yes, it's just one finger, I'm sorry. can we say that compassion is related to empathy? Because in my personal experience, I feel that when I empathize, I don't know if we say this, but when I recognize myself in the other, as if I, well, for some experience that I can relate because I already been there. So I'm more, if I recognize that, if I empathize, I can be more compassionate. Is this right or true? I don't know.
Well, I don't know about right and true, but maybe what you said at the end about how when you have this, when you can empathize, maybe it's easier for you to experience compassion. I think that I'm not sure what the definition officially is of empathy and the dictionary definition of compassion is, but I would say that compassion is all inclusive. We could empathize with someone and not feel compassion. Whereas compassion is all inclusive. And I know that compassion has a lot of religious overtones for people, especially who were raised in Catholicism. People don't, they kind of don't like that word. I don't know if it's like that in Portuguese Catholicism, but it's not like this bleeding heart type, you know, it's not like, you know, crying over people and things like that. Yes, tell me, you wanted to say something else?
Yes, I just remembered, and I think I will share. I remember my first retreat. I talked about compassion with the person who was there. And I remember that his definition of compassion was totally different. I don't have an exact or dictionary-like definition for compassion. I'm still searching, even for myself. But I remember that for that person, it was a definition more looked alike to the Catholic definition or what they think about compassion. And it was like that, you know, tears and bleeding and, well, suffering a lot and feeling pity. And it's not like that I see, but I also share with Joana the sometimes difficulty I have difficulty with compassion even for myself, and it's being a path that I'm walking through. And so, well, it was this. I just wanted, I had a, last weekend, I had a course through Zoom, and there was a lot of some person that I was feeling so annoyed, but you know, it was, and I was, every time, the question came to my mind. It was, why can I not accept the person, you know? Because I've already been there. I have already been that person that is always talking and is always me, you know? So it was a very extreme exercise of compassion for me to be 2 days, all day, hearing and dealing with my feelings and my difficulty in being compassionate. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, you know, this notion of I guess I understand from what you said that you would, the way that the person was behaving, you saw some of your own behavior sometimes. You recognized in that person's behavior, yeah. So then if we see, you know, who we truly are and see what brings us to act in that way, that would, you know, I don't know exactly what the person's motivation was, but wanting to be seen, wanting to be right, wanting to give a certain image to people, wanting to stand out, I don't know. Putting other people down, maybe, I don't know. We can see where that comes from. It comes from a not having a true image of ourselves, not having a good image, not seeing the beauty of this jewel that we are. Because if we see the beauty of it, of who we are, we don't need to promote it or put other people down. Because we see we are that jewel, but so is the other. And we don't need to make them feel bad. We don't even need to think that they are better than us. So we have to work to make ourselves seem better. That's when compassion arises, when we see that. Because then we can feel the pain that that person is probably feeling if they're acting that way. And we would like to help them ease that pain. Because we know what it's like to feel that pain. And we do whatever we can to not promote that pain and to help put an end to it. Even though you can't change someone's life, but you can, in the way that you respond to them, offer something other than aggression or anger or annoyance, whatever it is that we usually offer. It all comes down to seeing you are it. And when you see you are it, then you see the others are it. And then you cultivate this compassionate heart that makes us better people and makes it a better world, like that CEO said.
I'm sorry, I realized in that moment that accepting what I was feeling, it turned that much easier, you know. And realizing that I didn't have to do nothing because I have been there, and now I don't feel like I'm there, but I'm still annoyed. So at the same time, when we want to, and this is another question that I have, when I want to end suffering, or when I want to end, to put an end to a behavior or to something that shows me the person is suffering, of course, am I trying to end the suffering of others or myself? But then it relates with what you are saying. If we are one, of course that I am trying to put an end to the suffering of other, to take the suffering of myself. Does this make sense? I don't know.
I think so. I you know, we would probably have to go into more example, but the you know, Bernie Glassman used to say sometimes that there's what he would call stupid compassion, but not in a negative way, in the sense that maybe we are not acting from this place of oneness, and maybe there is some self-involvement in it. Maybe we are trying to put an end to our own suffering. But the important thing is that we're going in the way of doing less harm, even if there is something you're getting out of it. At least it's going towards not harming. And then you eventually work through it, and you deepen your experience, and there's less of that self-involvement in it. You don't do it so that for any particular reason. It's not about you. But it's okay if it is, because at least you're doing something that's going towards not harming rather than harming. That's what makes the world a better place, in that sense. limiting the harm. So we're about out of time here. Debbie wants to say one last thing.
I kind of have a request because this is very interesting and we are out of time. Can we come back to this, to what compassion means? Because the more you, I hear the word, more I realize I didn't have no idea what we're talking about, really. I mean, I have a whole bunch of ideas about what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I will make a note of this. So we do part two. To be continued, the next episode in our series. Yeah. Okay. It's like my teacher once, years and years and years ago, was talking about compassion. I've told this story before. And after the talk, I went and told her what a wonderful talk it was. It was fabulous, beautiful talk. I said, you really should talk about compassion more often, Roshi. This is just, she wasn't Roshi then. But this is so good. She kind of looked at me and she said, well, you know, I talk about compassion all the time, Amy. But I didn't hear it. So. I don't mean to tell you, Debbie, that I talk about it all the time and you're not hearing it. I'm not saying that. Okay, we chant our vows that we've just talked about.